Hello, and welcome to Heart, Soul, and Data, where we explore the human side of analytics to help amplify the impacts of those out to change the world. With me, Alexandra Mannerines.
By Dr. Tasha Parker, founder of the Institute of Development and extraordinary clinical psychologist. We are thrilled to be able to discuss some serious topics today around how the theory of a trauma-informed and therapeutic approach can help us in how we apply data to evaluation and to expanding and advancing our nonprofit and community causes. Dr. Parker is full of incredible wisdom. One of the things she brings that we are going to talk about is that data are so powerful because they uplift the stories of the people who are impacted by what we do. But data also move at the speed of trust. So listen in for how we explore how to use Dr. Parker's incredible and wise approach to therapy in how we bring data to our nonprofits. I am so excited today to be joined by Dr. Tasha Parker. I am going to let her share some of her incredible story, but let's start with just an introduction. Dr. Parker, how did you come to the world of data and where are you right now?
And so I'm located in Wichita, Kansas. I came through to the world of data via, well, it's interesting. I'll try to keep it short. So I've been doing clinical work for a very long time. About 12 years, I think, maybe 13. Started out really young, passionate about it, do really good clinical work, trauma work. But what I recognized is that regardless of how hard you work with people, like, you know, people give you the privilege to sit with them and they still have to go interact with systems that are inequitable, re-victimizing, traumatizing. And so it's like you're chasing your wheels. Like the work is needed, but I was like, how can you do it differently? And so I first got exposed to like true like data and evaluation. I was running the mental health at our county jail and we had to track a lot of things because we had this mental health pod. And when certain codes happen, you'd have to create this, you had to go investigate and figure out why, what happened, create policies on it. So that's when I really got exposed to data. And then I figured like, maybe I can mix this whole thing with tracking data because it's almost like treatment planning. With clients, I said, well, I can merge these together and versus just doing the one-on-one work with clients, I can do it with organizations, programs, and communities to help them leverage data, whether it be to improve programming, secure funding, accountability, all those different things.
And now you run the Institute of Development, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So share a little bit about why you started the Institute of Development and what you do there.
And so started Institute of Development in December of 21 while I was finishing up my PhD. So when I decided that I wanted to get more into consulting in relation to community and evaluation, I knew I needed methodology. And so I went back to school to get a PhD. And during that time, I was very fortunate to have my advisor, Dr. Rhonda Lewis, shout out to Dr. Rhonda Lewis at Wichita State. She was supporting me when I was telling her, like, you know, I can't go work for anybody. Because I had been in private practice, I don't know, since like 2015. I was like, I don't know what this looks like. But she said, great, do your own thing. This is what you need to do. This is what that can look like. And so that's what I did. I started the Institute of Development with this whole idea of bringing this therapeutic approach to research and evaluation and really coming from this harm reduction and equitable approach. A lot of people do equity work. However, I think it's important to do that work with this trauma-informed lens. And so at Institute of Development, we do a little bit of everything, strategy development, research evaluation, program development and implementation.
And we, of course, are so happy that you are here doing this work. And I always like to ask guests to share how they come to data because we bring so many different lenses to the data world. And I really want to abolish this myth that there is a traditional data background. And I love that you come to it from clinical psychology and that you are really able to use just this practical real world experience that you have in trying to help people and one of the really important tools to get there. And I think so often we think data are sort of, I don't know, impersonal or at the aggregate, right? They're trying to just tell us a general story. But what you talked about is being able to help individual people as well as many people as possible and needing data, which I think is a really compelling story.
I'm a clinical social worker in a community, a little feisty about those titles sometimes. But what I do want to caveat about what you said, we do typically use data as a very extractive, like in a very extractive way. So I think it's important to acknowledge that and where that comes from. It's really built in. Now, this is a Tashaism, but I think several people would agree. It's really built in like the white capitalistic use of data. And so I really want to change what that looks like, at least for how I use it and how I partner with communities and organizations, is going from that extractive piece and even not just de-aggregating data, using the data to inform action. Because you can de-aggregate the data all day, right? Mm-hmm. But what are you going to do after that?
Well, that's two really critical things that I wanted to follow up on. Let's start with the second one, where you talk about using data for action. So what are the biggest barriers that you've seen in how data are both collected and used that prevent it from being able to be truly actionable? And how are you addressing that in the Institute of Development and in your work?
I think a lot of it is sometimes funding, trauma, like systemic. So I think about trauma, there's different layers of it. So environmental, historical, and systemic trauma for organizations who are afraid to engage sometimes in data and evaluation because it's like, well, what if it says my program isn't doing good? Then it goes away. And it was like, well, there's other ways we can use the data. It's not just this good or bad extreme. So the barrier is understanding what data is and how you can use it. I think not being extractive about it, including the community in it, and then making it actionable. The barriers, the biggest barriers, so that's funding, knowledge, time, overall resources. And so when you think of resources, time, people, knowledge, right, and money. And so those are probably some big barriers that I've come to face. But a lot of it is people can't know what they don't know. And so like, how do you meet people where they're at to try to, because you can't remove all the barriers, but at least go to eliminate some of the angst about it. But also, like I said, data evaluation, when it comes to tracking things, that's really built in that white capitalistic society. Like, that's where it started. And unfortunately, it's been harmful to a lot of people. So, you know, you come in and like, don't be researching me. You know, what are you going to do with this? It's a lot of distrust, too.
I think that distrust is a big piece. I mean, In the nonprofit space, oftentimes data got its start in particular programs because somebody who controlled the resources, like a funder, said, we want blank data, or we want the data to be able to judge you. You know, going back to your previous comment about people are afraid to be judged and found wanting. And so I do think that building that trust is really important if you're wanting data to be used, right? If you want people to actually engage in the data, you do have to have that trust. The saying, right, data moves at the speed of trust, right? That it's just not going to go any farther than it's trusted. And there's a lot of elements of trust. Some of them, you know, are technical, are the data right? But a huge component of that trust is cultural.
Yeah.
That experience and that direct experience with who's used the data and what they've used the data for.
And being able to own, it's not just like you can't really. Like, I love equity, but I really don't know if it can exist without this trauma and resiliency informed approach, because it's one thing to acknowledge what's happening, but there's something else to acknowledge that I represent a system or a group of individuals that have perpetuated certain systemic inequities and caused harm. Like, we have to, as researchers and evaluators or data analysts or whatever, you know, new thing we want to call ourselves, is you have to acknowledge that regardless of how you're moving through the world, you're still a representation of a system that is far more inequitable and done more harm than you'll ever be able to rid.
So you mentioned that it's really not possible to separate data, as you said, from the past experiences, from the trauma, the experience of the cultural experience.
It's possible. I don't think you should.
Okay, well, tell me more
about
that.
Some people do it. I think some people really, it's the, I want to say rational ignorance, but I don't think that's the case. I think it's intentional because there are some people who move through this data world very extractive. Like they are aware of the history and all the things. And it's like, anyways, this is what we're still going to do. So you can do it,
right?
But you're not really doing it. And it comes at a cost.
That is very true. I think that's so. When I was writing my PhD thesis, I kind of butted heads with the more traditional expectations of the way this was supposed to be written because they didn't want me to say I. Mm-hmm. I was like, but I'm the one who's done the work. And the fact that I'm doing it will be different than if you did it versus if someone else, right? Like we can't help the point of views that we bring and the experiences we bring and our internal lenses that we're viewing the world and processing. And even it influences what questions I asked and didn't ask. And so to like, I think that idea of, well, science can be objective. Like, no, it can't. It's always going to be done by scientists.
Positionality, right? Yeah. I think you are a danger. So I think cultural humility and intellectual humility is so important, but you are dangerous if you're in any type of science, human research, if you don't have a positionality statement, and if you truly believe that that doesn't impact the way you do, it's like, it's not preventing bias. This is, I'm acknowledging that because of my positionality, these are the bias that I bring in. I'm going to keep it on the forefront, and I'm going to call it out to you too, but that's a whole nother thing.
Related to this, right? Mm-hmm. That by acknowledging that we're all humans and we can't exist, you can't experience the world as not a human. And data are just a map of the experience of whatever people have set up that data collection, right? You can't have the map completely represent the territory. And so therefore, there's going to be decisions made about what is put on the map and what's left off the map. And those decisions are influenced by the people making the choices. And so, like I said, just acknowledging that the best work you can do, you're still being done by humans. Like you said, that humility, I think, is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to come back, you know, as we talk about being humans, we bring our humanity to the collection of data and how we do that data, but we also bring it to how we use and understand data. And you'd mentioned earlier, you know, that fear of being judged. And I was curious if, you know, as a therapist, what lens do you bring to helping people be more comfortable with using data in evaluation or even, you know, within their own lives?
I think once it comes like down to meeting people where they're at, it's not my job to say, oh, you don't have anything to worry about. Yes, you do. Because this can impact things in several different ways. So it's like this balance of like, how do we be honest, direct, but also supportive? In it, like, yeah, it makes sense to be frustrated or, you know, disappointed about what we've discovered, but that's where the equity comes in. What's the plan? What's the actual plan? What are the things that we're going to do to address the opportunity gaps or continue to strengthen and bolster what's going well? Mm-hmm. And so that's where I think equity really comes in. And as far as the therapy piece, I always say it ain't on me, it's in me. Like, it's just kind of natural for me to meet people where they're at and just being able to sit with people in those difficult times, recognizing that I can't fix your emotion. Who am I to tell you how you're experiencing this? Like, who, if you say, you know what, Tasha, I don't feel like you did this evaluation right. Who am I to tell you, yes, I did. Like, no, that's your experience, but I can meet you where you're at and say, help me understand. It's leaning into, so back to your question, because I'm a rambler, that the therapy piece for me is listening to understand versus to agree and speaking to be understood versus to persuade, because two things can exist. I can understand you without agreeing, just like I can accept what you're saying and not approve of it. And so for me, that's what that balance looks like.
And I feel like also by starting with creating a space where people can just understand the data first, right? That you're not asking them to accept it to start with, that you're just saying, let's make sure we all understand it. That in some ways you might move beyond a lot of the initial emotional reactions because they may be too perceptions around the data. They may be to our fears of the data, not even anything the data actually are presenting or that we're intended to report on. and that you're saying, no, let's start with at least just like understanding that the same way. And you're modeling that by saying, I understand that you have whatever feelings you're bringing to this. I'm not going to judge you for them or tell you that you're wrong for having those feelings. And then together we can move to a place of, I think, more complete understanding, which then leads, like you said, to action. That once you have an idea of what the opportunity gaps are, something can happen. But it's hard to have that action on those opportunity gaps happen if you don't know what they are at all.
Yeah, right. And I think also there's a piece of being able to, at least on my end, when I'm working with people, recognizing when capacity and willingness is impacting each other. Sometimes I'm unwilling to do something that I don't believe that I have the capacity to. And so it's like, well, I don't understand. Do you really not understand? Right. And then also acknowledging that when I'm unwilling to do something, I may not have the capacity for it. And knowing when to like take a step back and circle. I'm a believer in circling back with people versus just trying like, no, we got 2 weeks. We got to really get this done. It's like this three-phase protocol. I always say in therapy, I work in three phases. And I've tried to take the same approach with the data work that I do is first figuring out where you really are. Not where you want to be, not where you tell the world, but like legitimately, where are you? From your core beliefs, your false core beliefs, all the things. How do we get here? And then we'll get you where you need to be. That's the quickest part. But we got to make it through those first two first, right? And it's difficult to say, hey, I'm afraid to do this thing because I believe that what I want to do or what I inspire this program to do isn't doing. Or I'm afraid my program's going to go away, whatever it may be.
And in many ways, those three phases are equally true for an individual engaging with data, right? You want to understand where people truly are. As you said, is it that they don't want to do it or they can't do it? And understanding, you know, what barriers might be there. We talked a lot about some cultural barriers and some trust barriers. And then saying like, okay, if we see where we are, either not engaged or not understanding or under-resourced, right? You just don't have the time or the money or the staff or whatever it is. And then we can figure out how we got there, what kept us from having the funding, what kept us from having the knowledge, whatever it might be. And then we'll address how we can actually build, you know, a space where we're able to safely engage with data. But that's also the data we want to have too, right? We want to have data on truly where our programs are. And we want to have data on how our programs got there. And then we'll have data to help us figure out where we want our programs to go. I don't know if that's at all kind of how you view it.
Well, and acknowledging the systemic piece, right? And acknowledge like how systemically that impacts things. So I think about it like the tree. When you think about resilient communities, often people talk about the tree. And with the tree, there are these, you know, we have the branches and the leaves and all the things where we are offering like program to individual, like it's the individual level of adversity. But when you look at the trunk and the roots of the tree, it's planted in the soil, right? And so regardless of what you do to these leaves, and you can provide them with all the lovely care, if the soil isn't nutritious enough, which is the systemic inequities, that tree is still only going to grow so much and is still going to go through certain things because of the lack of nutrition in the soil. So I think it has to be twofold, particularly when I think about equity in the work that we do. It's like, yes, I'm working with this program, but I'm also helping them be aware, acknowledge, and even advocate for the systemic pieces that are contributing to the need of their program and their ability for their program to be the greatest thing that it can be.
And what role does data play in that understanding and in that advocacy?
Mm-hmm. So it uplifts the stories of the people who are impacted, right? That's where it uplifts the stories, both whether it's quantitative and or qualitative, right? It's uplifting the stories of those who are being impacted by these systemic inequities and programming inequities. Like I think about, I don't know if you ever, there's a show on HBO Max called The Savior Complex. And when I watched it, I just kept thinking about this is why evaluation, like data is important, because even if it was just a small scale, some type of evaluation externally happening, some things could have been caught. Like someone could have figured something out, right? And I think that's where there's accountability piece, right? Like as a clinician, I have malpractice insurance, there's certain code of ethics and standards that I'm held to. And I feel like programs, so it's twofold. You know, we use data to help programs be better, but we also use data and evaluation to hold programs accountable, because you're accountable to the community that you're providing those services to. And you're accountable to ensuring that you are reducing harm, creating pathways to healing, but also operating in a way that change and transformation is possible. You didn't ask for all that, but you got it.
But that is exactly what we're talking about. And I think that accountability piece, I fully agree with that. I've always said we have a moral obligation to evaluate our programs, because if they're not doing what we say we're doing, then we're not stewarding our resources morally, right? As a nonprofit mm-hmm. who says that we exist to solve a problem. And, mm-hmm. you know, when you talk about that you have an accountability to your community, I think that does scare people a little bit about this.
Well, intent and impact aren't the same thing. I can be well-intended, but that doesn't mean that's the impact that I'm having on people. And to me, that's where it goes back to that trauma resiliency informed piece, is that I'm acknowledging, you know, these principles of transparency, collaboration, and at the different implementation domains, right? Because part of that is the evaluation.
To build on that, then what are some of the important questions that, you know, we as providers of a nonprofit service or of running a community organization that says we are here to do a thing, what are some of those really critical equity questions we need to be asking with our data? I think there's some really important questions that we ask of ourselves, like morally and personally, but from the view of data, what are some of those tough questions that we should be asking?
So the key question, and I read it, I didn't make it up. I read it and it was like, this is what I would center all the equity work around. This is how we're framing it. Who benefits and when do they benefit, right? I think that's so key. Who benefits and when? What's the plan of action? What are the resources needed to implement that plan of action? And who's going to hold who accountable for implementing that plan of action? Where's the change? And not just movement, like where's the change in progress? And there's a difference between change and transformation too, right? The whole thing of transformation. Dr. Jerry Peake says, you know, transformation is like, it's difficult to go back from transformation, but change, you can unchange the thing, right? You can like, oh, not anymore. And so I think those are the questions. You know, what does transformation look like? Who benefits and when? And who pays a cost? Because there is a cost to be paid, and you have to acknowledge that, and not just like hard costs, but soft costs. And did we do it in a harm reduction way? I think about, you know, the analogy where people like, the equity analogy, looking over the fence with the boxer. And, you know, they say, you know, the goal for equity is justice. So you remove the fence. But I think there's a piece that I don't, that we also have to acknowledge, because some people have been straining to look over the fence so long, or standing on the box for so long, like there are now things that they have to heal and deal with. And so we have to also address those things. And we can't just get rid of the boxes, because we remove this fence to this game. What about other people who didn't remove their fences? And who's going to address, if I strain for too long, who knows? Maybe my ankle's sore now, or maybe I walk on my tiptoes, or maybe I need glasses now. And true equity work is embodies that trauma piece of creating pathways to healing. So just because you remove the fence, it doesn't mean that I haven't been impacted. And where is my pathway to healing so I can sustain and really be able to utilize whatever changes that have taken place because we have moved from equity to justice.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say that there is a responsibility to not just define those pathways programmatically, or even just, I mean, I think there's a lot of lip service to that, right? We'll talk about that, but in terms of actually taking action, we expect to see that in programming or services or in the construction of that. But is there also a space for the way your evaluation is constructed to take that in?
Absolutely. It's like, who voices do you include? Mm-hmm. How do you provide recommendations? What do those recommendations look like? Are you practicing from this sustainability point of, are you setting these organizations up to, at some degree, continue to do the work even when you're gone? Mm-hmm. Like, those are the things that I think about.
Mm-hmm. The recommendations one is a really interesting piece. You know, we had talked about when we first touched base around the idea that part of your evaluation of, you know, who benefits and when is an acknowledgement of what your services can't do. Mm-hmm. And that in using data and evaluation to acknowledge where you're not going to be helping somebody, and identifying mm-hmm. that who and the when that those gaps occur, that you would have an obligation then, having had that data to show you it, to build those recommendations to say, we can't do that. And maybe it's intentional because we want to make sure that we're focusing on the stuff we do well, and that's not our space. But here are organizations who could help you with that. Here are resources that can support you through that. So to your point, you know, if you're really focused on taking down a fence, that you say, I understand that you may need some physical therapy to help you with your ankle or your
glasses. That's the word, physical therapy.
Yeah, you know, and just say like, here's a physical therapy organization because we're a construction organization, right? And I'm making a sort of lighthearted joke of a very serious subject, but that idea that like we can't all do it all, but then rather than saying, well, therefore not my problem, that you can build those networks of recommendation.
True innovation is collaboration, right? True innovation is collaboration. I'm a lead scholar this year, and we were having a conversation after curriculum and we were talking about individualism in this work. And one of my colleagues said, individualism is rooted in white supremacy, right? And I think it goes back to that it can only be one of us, right? And so I am the one with all the things, with all the programming who does all the things. Well, you can't do all the things. I mean, you can, but that doesn't mean you do it well. And it comes at what cost? Because some programming is better than none, right? We know that. Some programming is better than none. And so, however, when you're doing 15,000 things, you only do one well. And now, because funders are wanting more data, and then you can't justify or speak to the impact that you're having, that program goes away. And who suffers? The community. That's who suffers. And so if you really want to be innovative, you want to play the long game, how do we collaborate in a way that's also equitable? That's the other piece. And that even comes down to program development. You know, people think about evaluation, they always go to impact. But how? There's a difference between formative and summative evaluation.
Tell me more about that.
And so often when people think about evaluation, they think about summative, of like, we're summarizing, this is the impact that you're making. But what it really comes down to, I can never impact, my programming is never going to reach the desired impact if it's not implemented how it was supposed to. So figuring out and tracking and monitoring how I'm delivering my program, and if I'm delivering it how I said I was going to the people that I said I was going to. I got to figure that out first before I can even measure impact, because if I'm supposed to be feeding kids lunch and instead I'm buying them books and giving them backpacks, that's good. However, that's not how my program was designed. And so I'm never going to reach this impact. So sometimes that means like, let's re-strategize our programming. But other times, like, we just need to reshift, right? And develop a network with someone who maybe they do feed kids when I was supposed to, but I'm not. How to re-leverage that?
That makes a lot of sense. And I love that idea because I agree with you. I think a lot of times we think of evaluation, we solely mean that impact at the very end. But if you don't know if you're being true to what you said you were going to do, or even sometimes trying to figure out what is the best thing to do, right? You may need some pilot studies. You may need hypothesis testing within the development of that program to know, like, if this is the ultimate impact we want, what's a reasonable way to try to get there? Use that to develop the programs and then say, do we have that high fidelity? Are we being true to the programs we have developed? Otherwise, there's no point to evaluation at the end. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the metrics and the data and the framework, the mindset that we're bringing to this varies? We've been talking a lot about it from the provider point of view, someone, an organization or someone providing services to a community. But does that vary if you're a funder? Should you be thinking differently about data, or does the whole thing pretty much map on whether you're the funder or the provider? Or also to add in a whole other, if you're a recipient, right, of such services, how does that whole data view change?
I don't think it changes much. I think funders have the same responsibility. You're accountable to the dollars that you're given. Mm-hmm. Right. But you're also accountable because, you know, a lot of funders are moving towards this equitable grant making, like sharing power. But you have to do it in a way that you are providing people with technical assistance, like a way that's reducing harm still. And so I think funders are just as accountable. And I actually believe that sometimes they need to be clear about their data collection procedures, but also provide some type of support to organizations to measure.
Really good piece of that, as funders have been ramping up their requests for data, that they've largely been doing it in a way where they then say, oh, well, but your data staff would count as overhead and we won't fund that.
When they don't even have the time they collect data, if you, what are you using it for? What are you going to use that for? Please help me understand how that's going to help you. What's the question that you're even trying to answer, right? And that's that equity piece. Who benefits and when? Who benefits from collecting this data and when will they benefit?
And what's the cost of it?
There you go.
Right, because data collection doesn't happen in a vacuum.
No, it's chaotic. It's completely chaotic. I love it, but it's so chaotic.
Right. We've talked about a lot of, heady things here, a lot of complex things that are not necessarily going to be solved just overnight. But I was wondering if you could share an example of a nonprofit that, and you can mask them or de-identify them. They don't have to be called out. But an example of where you've worked with them to develop an evaluation approach that really has shown some measurable advancements in equity and sustainability.
I can't think of any like that, like doing the work now, but I can talk to you about an organization here in Wichita who we have the plan. So now we're just waiting. We'll implement the project and evaluation piece starting next year. And it's promising, but it's promising because of their ED is something different. I've never met anybody like her before, but she truly, like, justice is important to her and like collaboration. And she understands and acknowledge how data can help the sustainability in their program in relation, not just financially, but sustainability of like keeping those stories going and ensuring that people know what's happening. And so we have a pretty cool evaluation plan that we've outlined outside of what's required from the funder that I think is a completely different twist on how this, because it's a global program that we're implementing, that is completely different than any evaluation that's been done on this program. But I'm biased because I think she's the bomb. I think our team's the bomb and we got some cool things planned. So next year, this time, we should circle back and then I can tell you the story.
I'm so excited. I love it. It's a date. October next year, we'll check in again and I can't wait to hear that story. Well, while we're waiting for that story, what would be one thing that you could suggest to someone listening right now who has been inspired by the work that you are doing every single day, who's been inspired by these conversations of how we can rethink our approach to data? What could they do now that would have some of these impacts down the road?
Like they is just anybody or like a data person?
Actually, we can ask it at a couple of different levels. So let's say you are a program manager. Mm-hmm. Right? You manage a program. You're not the executive director. You're a program manager. What would be one thing that you as a program manager could do to implement at least one thing from today?
I would talk to the people that I'm delivering programs to and say, hey, how would you measure our success? Let them tell me and then start there. Then I'm going to go to somebody, talk to somebody, go to the interweb and say, okay, how can I start collecting just this little bit of data? You got to go to the people. I'm going to tell you how my program is successful. You tell me this, if this program, I think they should talk to the people delivering the program directly and the people who are receiving. If this is successful, what does that look like? I think that's a must first step.
And the interesting thing is as scary as that might feel, it's not complicated, right?
No,
it might feel hard, but it's not complicated that anybody could do that.
To literally just ask, if this was working, how would we know?
Yeah. And then people, like you said, tell figure you. Out, yeah. And then figure out one data point that would help you answer, is it doing that thing that they said? Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go back and say, hey, this is the data point that I think I want to collect. What do you think about this? But then I'm going to go back to them again once I start collecting the data and say, hey, this is what I made sense of. What does it mean to you? Mm-hmm. Then I'm going to go back and say, okay, this is what I want to do. What do you think about these action steps?
It was like you were saying earlier that you're not just a one and done, right? That there's the continual recircling, right? That coming back and coming back and coming back, because often this work is never done.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you're an executive director, let's say, so you run the organization, maybe you're not involved as much in the day-to-day of the programming. What would be one thing that you would say as a leader would be really important?
As a leader, I think it's really important to figure out some way, even if it's a little smidgen of a budget, how can I put a little line item in there to get us started? So maybe it's just a little bit of data coaching. little bit of technical assistance for somebody who's just going to help coach me or coach somebody within our organization. And it can't just be anybody. I think it has to be someone who understands what it means to be culturally responsive, what it means to be equitable, what it means to engage in participatory research and community engagement.
I like that. I completely agree with the importance of leaders making a statement of investing in data to say this matters. We need this. And that I like that you led with the coaching piece, not let's invest in a technological system, not right, but that no, we need to be able to support our team and carve the, not just the money, but the time, right? Right? Because if you're doing 15 things and they're like, oh, by the way, yeah, get some coaching. And you're like, when?
It's readiness. It's organizational readiness. And what are the things that contribute to that? And we forget about those things, but as ED, that's definitely what I would do. And once again, I would talk to people within my organization. I would talk to the recipient of our services as well.
Get that feedback. Well, thank you so much for this conversation today. If people would like to connect with you, follow you, find out more about the Institute of Development, where can we send them?
You can check me out on my website at www, or shoot me an email at Tasha.
Excellent. Well, thank you again so, so much for your time today and sharing your wisdom and your experience and your incredible depth of knowledge.
Thank you.
Please be sure to follow up with Dr. Tasha Parker. In the show notes below, we've got links to her organization as well as to other ways you can contact her, because I hope you are going to take her up on her invitation to really see how data and evaluation can hold programs accountable, can hold us to doing what we say we are going to do. And if you ask yourself that key equity question, who benefits and when, from your data, from your programs, and from how you approach evaluation and the use of data across your organization, I would love to hear what you find in answer. So please drop comments below or reach out to us at Heart, Soul, and Data. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope that you learned as much as I did. And I wish you the most joy on your data journey, wherever it may take you.
You have been listening to Heart, Soul, and Data. This podcast is brought to you by Moroccanos, an analytics education, consulting, and data services company devoted to helping nonprofits and social enterprises amplify their impacts and thrive through data. You can learn more at moroccanos.com, MERAKINOS.com.